Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience with Darren and Mark and a special guest.
Welcome once again to the Fan Experience Experience podcast series. Each podcast will explore a different element of the fan experience and fan engagement. Some will look at the matchday experience while others will explore broader themes. But every podcast will deliver value to anyone listening in football or indeed any other spectator sport. So whether it's general advice you need or ways to help you start a conversation with your own colleagues, we reckon a regular dose of the fan experience experience will make a difference. So join me, Mark.
And me, Darren, as we explore ways of improving the experience on match days, making clubs more sustainable and relying less on winning to keep those fans engaged.
And of course, as you know by now, if you'd like to find out more about the Fan Experience Company and the work we do, please check out our new website at www.fanexperienceco.com. As we said at the start, we look at broad themes sometimes, and on this particular podcast, that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be looking at the importance of club identity, of standing for something, of having values, and actually being different, perhaps communicating and conveying more than just somewhere where there's a game of football. I think you and I, Darren, as we've looked at non-league football in this country, and certainly as we've gone up through the leagues, that's one area where we've found, well, plenty of gaps and a big opportunity.
Yeah, you can really make a difference with identity. But I think one of the things that I was going to say we always say, but I think you always say, is that that very often it's the fans who know the identity and what a club stands for far more than the club itself.
Absolutely, absolutely important. I mean, because I think we're going to have a challenge post-COVID too, where clubs are going to have to be conscious of the fact that leisure spend will be squeezed, and they're really going to have to diversify their reach, engage their communities more, and become more than a football club. We know we've found some great examples as we've gone around. Lewis has been a good example. I think, you know, our producer's been on a couple of occasions recently, and he always finds it very unique. And they're probably the clubs that we remember the most. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, well, I suppose it goes back to the very fact that if you can't control winning, which we know you can't, then actually if fans are going to have a great experience or at least come away with something quite memorable, then actually those are the sort of things that are going to make a real difference.
And it is true that member-owned clubs or fan-owned clubs seem to be those who find it, well, who make it a priority and appear to find it easier, as we've said before, to kind of realise that identity and value. We're delighted to have on this podcast Dan Lambert from the Bohemian Football Club, as it is, but bows to everyone else from Dublin. Morning, Dan. How are you?
Good. Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
It's a real pleasure. I mean, you and I have spoken from time to time, but I was over there in around 2013, 2014, which is kind of the before and after, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it would have been, we went through a very difficult time. It's coming on now, kind of 8-10 years ago. And it really, we've said it before in the media in Ireland here, but it really got to the stage where we, a couple of times we thought we'd had our last kind of club board meeting, and we are the oldest club in our league. We've competed there since 1890. We've never been relegated. We've always been fully member owned. So it was really tricky times. And we've come out of it stronger than ever. Which is remarkable when you think now where we were a relatively short amount of time ago. We've bigger attendances, we've more members than we've ever had. Every measure has increased far beyond where it was and what we thought were good times.
And the curious thing is, the two things that have stubbornly remained the same are the stadium, which is still in its very old-fashioned kind of, you know, can't quite use all of the bits look, and the fact that you still haven't won anything.
Yeah, we haven't won anything through all of these years. As our crowds have kept growing and growing and growing every year for the last 5 years in a row, to the point now where we're totally sold out every game. And we haven't won anything now. We've qualified for Europe. We've had a great team and a great manager. But none of this has been down to on-the-pitch success and trophies, which you know, is really rewarding as a club. And, of course, you want to aim to win things. And that's, you know, everyone would like to win the league and win a cup, but to be able to have done what we've done without winning things is it's really interesting, and I think we've learned a lot from it as a club.
Dan, just backtracking to, you said you thought you'd had your last board meeting. Can you expand on that? How bad were things, and why did you think that?
Yeah, we had, I suppose, as a members-owned club, the the board of the people who were elected by the members to run the club would change fairly often. And there was a big change in the group of people who came in, and the people who came in around 2010-11, we inherited kind of a bit of a financial mess. A lot of it was down to a failed stadium sale that was planned, and it coincided with the collapse of the Irish economy. So the most basic way to explain it is we inherited a debt of about €7 to 8 million with no capacity to repay it at all. We couldn't actually pay the interest on it. And it was fairly likely that the bank were going to move on the club to sell the sole asset, which was the stadium. So that was the kind of environment we were operating in. And there was one season when we cut our budget by about 92%.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, and you know, as I said, the perception of the club was probably the lowest it had ever been. When people heard the name Bohemians, they what they thought instantly was a club that's bankrupt, a club that is going to go out of business, and pretty much a failure. Really, that's where we were. So that's the point we've come from.
But that, of course, that was the catalyst. Obviously, it often is when things reach a point where you can't keep doing the same thing, you know, and expecting different results. But it's the kind of, you'll tell me how it happened. There's a very kind of clear view as to what it was that you wanted to do, wasn't it? You wanted to be, you'll tell us more, but some of the factors were really focusing on community engagement, on focusing on concepts such as local, and this idea of attracting high quality fans. I thought that was quite a useful thing when you and I were talking recently and mentioning that. So tell us a little bit more about what you did, what you set out to try and be from, say, you know, 2012, 2013 onwards.
Yeah, I suppose, look, the years just before that collapse, the club was focused on one thing. And we say club now. Everything the club did was about one team, and that was the team who played on Friday nights or when the games are played in Ireland. And all our focus was on this team, and could that team win a trophy? And we were pretty successful just before the collapse. We'd won a couple of leagues, we'd won a couple of cups, we'd been in Europe. But it was all based upon this concept of you're coming to see a football team and that football team are going to win games. And it was that one-dimensional. That was it. We'd have ads in newspapers and they'd say, come and see live football. Like, so it was very one-dimensional. And I suppose when we step back, as you said, and you're completely right, you know, it served as a catalyst when we came so close to going out of business. We looked at it and said, you know, if we were to list the name Bohemians and list out all the other 19 clubs in Ireland in the Premier and First Division, you know, what would the average person on the street think if they looked through those names? And we realised that what they'd say is that they're 20 football clubs. Mm-hmm. There was no way of differentiating anybody. And when you looked at our history as a members-owned club for 130 years this year, you know, our stadium, which has huge history to it, the location in Dublin where we are in a very old part of the city, very close to the city centre, we had a lot of natural qualities that we weren't kind of focusing on, and we'd become irrelevant to the local community. And we were in a very, like, our stadium, for anyone who wants to take a look, is called Dalymount Park. If you look on the internet, it's surrounded by laneways. It's like something from an old comic book in the 1950s. It's all terraced housing all around it. And a lot of people in the community didn't know anything about us. They'd stopped coming to games a long time ago.
And you talk about relevance, and I think that's such an important point, because, you know, it's okay to have an identity. It's okay to profess to, you know, to subscribe to a set of values, but actually being relevant, you know, having a voice that's immediately recognizable, because you've gone from being, you know, just one of 20 to being completely unique. And I might be wrong, but haven't you had kind of the biggest commercial burst in terms of income just when there's actually been a lockdown in football and no one's played, you know, through people actually buying stuff online from your club shop?
Yeah, our online shop has done really well through this period. And again, I think that's down to the fact that people identify with our values, and they know that now is a tricky time for football, so they're willing to support us, and it's not, and they're happy to do that. We sell merchandise kind of now globally, and again, this is so far from where we were. It's almost, you know, it's almost not real. You couldn't have imagined Bohemians 5 years ago, 6 years ago, you know, selling shirts to all over the UK, to Germany, France, Spain, America. It's fantastic. And what I think has happened is that the values that we identified and we tried to communicate, and first and foremost, these values were built upon the local area. As you said earlier, you've got to do the right thing. You can't say you do the right thing, you know, in a big sense and not do good things in your local area. It has to start there. It has to be real. And our president at the club, Chris Bryan, who is president, you know, who has been the president for a long time now, he had a short gap, but he was there 2010, 11 when times were tough. He had a big focus on the local area, what we could do, and to do good things in the area for the sake of doing good things. It wasn't a PR exercise and it wasn't a marketing exercise. But once we built on that and began to, you know, outline our values and put them out there in all our communications, we found we just got a big response from people. And it was all stakeholders, the local residents, our own fans, players who joined the club want to get involved in what we do. And then we get it back from commercial partners, from the media. So it's just been a really good thing to do. And we've kind of refocused now. Like, we are obviously a football club and we do want to win trophies, but you can be only one team in the league each year can win the league. And as you said at the start, you can control more or less everything you do at a football club apart from what happens on the pitch. So, you know, you've got to accept that sometimes you'll win, sometimes you won't, but you can do everything else in a really good way, bringing, you know, a lot of energy and kind of good actions in all you do, and people respond to that.
Dan, just one question on that. And obviously, as you just alluded to at the start, in the intro, we mentioned relying less on winning. And that's a message we often try to get across to clubs that we speak to, that, you know, if you're relying on winning, it's a very dangerous strategy. But from your perspective, how, after what you've done and what you've seen, how important is winning to fans, do you think?
I think fans think it's really important. But then when you sit down and you chat to them, I think if you talk to a guy who's been a fan for 20 or 30 years and you talk about best memories, some of them might be a game where you won a league or cup. It's very often the friendships they've made, you know, time they spent with a grandparent or a close friend, that's something that, and it's funny when you have these conversations with people, they realize suddenly that, you know, the winning are things that they do remember. It might be a league win or a cup win, but really the things that are most important to them aren't that. They're emotional connections. It's almost like a religious experience. If you're involved with a football club, it means much more than the sum of its parts. And I really think, you know, it seems really important on the day. No one wants to lose to their rival. You know, if we're playing Shamrock Rovers in Dublin, all fans want to win that game. I want to win it. Shamrock Rovers want to win it. That's the way it is. But you realise when you look back and you step back from the emotion of being at a game, that what a football club gives to you, the winning element is, I'd say it's probably 5%. There's an awful lot more to it. And
I so agree with that. I mean, I, as Mark often reminds people, I'm a Walsall fan. And I remember one run when we didn't win for 16 games. And by the end of I think it was the 16th game, we lost to a non-league team at home in the cup. And I still remember that night because it was one of the... And this sounds weird because it wasn't really that funny because we were losing to a non-league club. But the camaraderie and the enjoyment in the crowd was better that night than I can remember it on many other occasions, which doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's just how it was. And I still remember that game now, and it was probably 10 years ago.
I think you're right. I mean, I can identify with that. Obviously, you know, the Sunderland's travails over the past couple of seasons. There is a kind of camaraderie in defeat, because you know that the true fans are the ones that are still supporting the club, that are still there. And this brings us back to that high quality fan, because that's what you're describing, aren't you? Someone who doesn't just buy into the concept of winning, but actually buys into the wider purpose of the club.
Absolutely. And that's what, and when we said we kind of worked on a strategic plan around 2015, and one of the key goals in that was to insulate ourselves from football results. So we wanted to be able to see, you know, if we were winning the league or second or seventh or eighth or tenth, that we'd get a pretty consistent crowd into the games. And that wasn't something that had really happened in Ireland, and we've managed to do that. And it really was around that, as like just communicating values to people, they buy into them. And communicating the club values, not just team values. So, you know, your women's team, your kids' teams, what you do in the local area. When you communicate these broad set of values, and people have so many reasons for coming to the game that they're almost innumerable. So they come and they definitely want to see the team win, because that's a good thing to happen. That's nice. But it's only a small part of the reason they've come. So they've come and they're proud of the club. And that's a key aim. Like, people should be proud of the club that they're associated with.
Do you actually articulate what the values are? Because, you know, we see some of the, and I'll just describe for our listeners just some of the specific things that you do. But do you actually have somewhere printed a list of specific values that you try to make sure are reflected in every decision you take?
There's some that are inherent. It's a great time to ask this, because we're just working on this now. And what we plan to do is to work on kind of, well, it's still to be agreed with the board, but we had this discussion last week, and we want to kind of have a fan kind of weekend almost, where we bring in different groups and get all it, because they aren't fully, like, they've never been put to an AGM at a club to be agreed, but they've come out naturally from things. So we'd say, for instance, because we're member owned, and we always have been, that we'd be, you know, we're inclusive and progressive by design. And the idea of a collective ownership and a kind of active citizenship is inherent in everything that Bohemians has done since its foundation. Obviously, volunteerism, the club's, but like, I'm not paid as a director, either any of the other directors. There's no financial remuneration for anybody. But this idea then of, you know, being a force for good, which sounds kind of real high and mighty, but it's literally just about, you know, spending time doing good things in the local area, also fostering creativity. It was actually Lewis, he mentioned earlier, where we now have a team of artists that do kind of match day posters for each game, and they're separate pieces of artwork, and they've been really well received. And we have a club poet, and, you know, we've obviously come out with some pretty big statements with refugees welcome, working with Amnesty International. So it's just, they're kind of just natural values. We see that the club should be a platform to assist other people. For instance, you know, there is an issue in Ireland with how people are treated when they arrive to the country. And we thought that was, football is a global game. You know, people come to Ireland, they mightn't speak English, but they speak football, and that we could assist in that. So a lot of them have happened quite naturally. And obviously, you know, there's other quite basic things that should have happened a long time ago. Like, we have an LGBT supporters group. Again, it's not commonplace in Ireland. And to just, we came out, there was a marriage equality referendum in Ireland. And, you know, football clubs and sports clubs didn't really go near that. They saw it as political, but we saw it as a human rights issue and one the club should stand for. So it hasn't been formally put down in a charter, although it's something we'd like to do. It's just, we looked at what the club stood for, what it was about. And a lot of this just comes from the fact that, you know, big money coming into football has happened in our league as well. And you realize too, when big money comes in, that you can't compete with that. And your fans understand that too. You know, it's not possible for us to make a loss of a couple of million quid a year where it is for a US investment company.
One of the things that just made me smile just then, as you went through the list of the things you're doing, you almost went straight past the club poet. You're actually, it's almost like we have in the UK here, we have a poet laureate who sits for a period of time, I think 4 or 5 years, and then another one is re-elected. You're on to your second, I believe, is that right?
Yeah, it's been amazing. It happened, the first one was a guy, Lewis Kenny, who's a good friend of mine and lives right beside the stadium. And we're now on to our second, is John Cummins. And the profile that they've gotten for themselves, and fully deserved, like amazingly talented people, but the profile they've gotten for the club, and it's gotten to the stage where I've realized that football is very hard to convey, as we know, like the emotion and the passion and the, you know, the things that are going on in a football field. A poet can actually capture a lot of that in a way that you can never put down, you know, if somebody couldn't write in a novel form or anything. So our manager has actually had both of them in to speak to the players, to perform poems to them, which is brilliant, you know.
I think that's lovely. I mean, there was an example from Brentford in the Championship last season where they have a Danish manager, Thomas Frank, and he'd been asked by the marketing guy if it would be possible for kids who were drawing good luck messages on a big poster before the game to actually bring it in about an hour and a half before, or an hour before kickoff, 45 minutes before kickoff, so the players, when they came in after the warm, could see these messages. And actually what Thomas Frank said was, no, I want you to bring it in 10 minutes before kickoff, when the players are actually here, so they can get that motivation directly from those kids' little messages. And I guess that having a poet does that. And there's also the, I'll get this wrong, so you're probably best telling it, but working with local prisoners in terms of using comedy as rehabilitation, is that right as well, isn't it?
Yeah, our foundation, the biggest prison in Ireland is right beside our stadium too. It's called Mountjoy. And we basically go into the prison and do a range of programs. So there's coaching inmates and try and get a qualification in coaching and to help reoffending levels go down when they come out. But we've also worked there with top comedians in Ireland to go in and run workshops where the inmates do their own stand-up routines. And again, this seems like, what is a football club? You know, why is a football club involved in that? But the way I picture it is simple. You take any football stadium or any sports club, irrespective of what sport they're involved in, you take that the 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 square miles around that area, you have a totally broad spectrum of just citizens, men, women, different ages, different interests. Your club can be a center point for that community. And whether people like football or not is irrelevant. So like, we, you know, we've got a choir now and we should build a load more of these things. The football club can be the center of the community or any other club. And, you know, our choir, the people who sing in the choir, some of them have no interest in ever seeing a football game, but suddenly they identify as part of the Bohemian family. They're linked to the club in this way, the artist, the poet, whether it's work that we do in the community or whether it's just a guy who says, I love football and I want to go every Friday and watch a football game. To become relevant in your area, you know, you've got to appeal to more people than just this tiny, narrow group. You've got to appeal to everybody.
Is it right as well, Dan, that you extend that by the food and the drink available at the stadium is linked to local businesses?
Yeah, and again, that's something, to be fair, I saw that and went to visit FC United a couple of times, and I saw that that was something that they did really well. And again, it makes total sense, like right down to the beer we sell. Like we've been selling, you know, to use an example in Ireland, we've been selling Guinness forever in our stadium. But Guinness is a big global company. They're owned by Diageo. They've never been interested in sponsoring Bohemians. And you're selling a whole lot of their beer, and you're like, hold on a second. If we sell some local beers, like Porterhouse, which is now one of our sponsors, they're a small independent brewery, they want to get involved with you. It makes financial sense. It makes sense for you know, because it sticks to what your values are as well. So these things make sense on every level. And it's only when you begin to look a bit deeper, you realize the simple moves that you can make in every area that reinforce your values, but also work for you, work for the club, and again, make it a bit, they make you more identifiable and more relevant, as we said.
What's so good about this is that it's scalable, and it's scalable down to the smallest clubs, the ones who face the biggest difficulties as we come out of COVID. I think an example that I saw recently, I was privileged to meet Wendy Newey, who is the chairperson, I believe, of a what is actually called Nene Valley Community Centre. It was actually a football club, but they realised their truer purpose was as a community centre. And just one example of what they do is they recognise that the changing rooms were only ever being used at weekends and then maybe a couple of nights a week. So they decided to spend a lot of time tidying them up, and actually they hire them out to the community. And the NHS locally has block booked about 2/3 of these converted rooms during the week for things like physiotherapy, for rehabilitation, because, you know, they don't have the facilities and the space in the hospital. You know, and I think that's something that you say that once you realize what you stand for and what your potential is and what your natural values are, there's no telling, you know, where you might, you know, where you might go. And of course, the current situation is that you've never been more sustainable. You're producing the best commercial results you've ever had. You've got the highest attendances you've ever had. And you're becoming one of those clubs in that kind of select band of, you know, the Lewis we mentioned, there's Dulwich Hamlet over here. And, you know, San Paoli, for example, I know they're changing at the moment, not with everybody's agreement, but that uniqueness and those black and red colours now. And you even have a graffiti competition, is that right?
Yeah, we around the stadium, as I mentioned, there's laneways that come up. And again, you kind of, to build that sense of like your identity, and also for children and people to build the anticipation coming up when you're queuing. We worked with local street artists in Dublin, and like every town, every city, every village across Ireland, the UK, has, you know, great graffiti artists. And very often the issue for them is where can they paint and not get arrested. So we gave them blank walls, and we outlined some of the, you know, colour schemes, some of our history. And you don't want to take away people's creative freedom. So you say, look, this is roughly what we're about. How about you encapsulate that in some pieces? It's been fantastic. You know, tourists come now around the stadium to take photographs. When we take press shots of our players, we get players to stand out there, like similar to what St. Pauli do, because it just makes you look a bit different. And it is more about your values rather than someone in an office. And, you know, like you said it there earlier on, what's important for stadiums or any facilities is that they aren't used a whole lot just for football. The more people that you can include in your club that just they become aware that it's there. It could be you know, a mother going to have a yoga class somewhere and bringing her kids, but suddenly they're aware that you're there. So, you know, build into as many different groups you think as possible. And whether that's graffiti artists, poets, it doesn't really matter what the outlet is. It's that they buy into what you're about and they help reinforce that message, and you give people a platform then to display their skills as well. So everybody's getting something from it.
Dan, do you think that, and obviously Mark's already sort of alluded to earlier, that more football clubs are going to have financial issues and are going to need to sort of reinvent or restart after we come out of the pandemic. Where do you see member-owned clubs as part of the future?
I think what's funny about a members-owned club, and we struggle with this all the time, like everything that we've done has been through a group of volunteers. And I think members-owned clubs, what's frustrating at times is that private money can always outspend you. But I think the member-owned club will always outlast the private money. So, you know, we came close to going out of business, but it was down to the members in a big way. The members really dug deep because they valued this thing that they owned collectively. And I think that when you look at it, you know, as I said at the start, this is our 130th season. We've never been relegated. You know, there's clubs that have won more trophies than us. But it's an extraordinary thing, really. You've got, you know, a big group of just ordinary people in a city that own a football club. And that's something that, you know, modern society has kind of began to break down those opportunities. So I think that you face challenges all the time. It is hugely frustrating when you're you know, making a small profit and you're trying to progress things in the right way, and somebody lands in with a big check and signs your best player. But as a club, you know, if you just move away from that and look at the club as a whole and something, as I said, to be proud of, I think that the members own club is the way to go.
Is Samuel L. Jackson really a fan?
Yeah. He supposedly is. If a member of the club was working in Hollywood and had him out there, we've had a few people like that. We've had kind of Fat Boy Slim also puts up a big an image from one of our games as the backdrop for a lot of his gigs. And when he last came to Dublin, we met him and he got a membership and things. So we've had a few of these unusual fans crop up here and there.
But of course, it's just the uniqueness that attracts him. And I think that's what's good about it. I also, you know, as we've talked about this a lot in conversations, Darren and I and the producer, about how it's often the case that a club has to hit the disaster before it then becomes fan-owned, you know. And it would be great if actually clubs were able to have, you know, progressive directors and owners who actually recognise that, you know, having fan representation on the board, using the German model of 51% fan ownership, actually has this huge impact on clubs' abilities to be recognisably authentic and a force for good.
Time for the roundup.
And it's the roundup. And the roundup, we say roundup, suggesting we're going to go through lots and lots of points, but actually what we generally do is pick up on one thing that's of interest to us. And this story you'll find on the website under the latest section, www.fanexperienceco.com. And that's that La Liga are going to be dealing with a lack of fans in their stadium as they return to football by having CGI fans, computer-generated fans, together with EA Sports authentic sounds of fans in the stadium. Now, when Javier Tebas, the guy who runs the La Liga, launched this, mentioned this just yesterday, he said that he found this would have a special appeal to the global fan base. What do we think about that, Darren? Do we think it's a good thing? Do we think actually we're going to see a future where for the elite clubs, the stadium will actually become FIFA and the rest of us will be the ones with the real fans? Am I just panicking?
I really hope you are panicking and that's not the case. I mean, I'm going to sort of sit on the fence on this one. I was reading a similar story about the potential for the Premier League to have fan sounds sort of available to listeners or viewers, and I'm really not sure. I hear the technology is very clever, so I'm hoping that it can sort of correspond with what's happening on the pitch, because that would be quite awkward if it was just very random. But I guess, you know, for me, that kind of, you know, computer generated noise is probably best on the computer games, but maybe I'm just being old fashioned.
Well, I don't know. Maybe what they should have is periods of calm where there's actually nothing happening on the pitch, and then EA Sports can conjure up a voice with a West Midlands accent shouting, you know, booted into Rose Z.
That is actually why I think my biggest problem with it is. And that's if you watch a game of FIFA, for example, or you play a game of FIFA, then literally the crowd are just making noise all the time, and I actually think if that was reality, and especially if I ever play a game with Warsaw, for example, I'll think, well, actually, if it was reality, there would be like 10 minutes of complete silence with just the odd groan, and FIFA never seems to get that. So I'm wondering if they'll put that into the that they'll do that with the stuff in the Liga as well.
Does FIFA use real referees? Because I remember being at a game once, I think it was a Cardiff City game, when Trevor Kettle was the referee, and somebody turned around to us and said, he's gone off the boil today. And I just love to, you know, I'd love EA Sports to think about putting that into the sounds. But listen, time's ahead of us. So I think this has been a fantastic podcast, Dan. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Minion.
No, and we'll be over there just as soon as you're up and running. We'll be walking down that Ginnel and enjoying some of the porterhouse. Thanks for spending time with us today. Good luck. Take care of yourselves. And for everybody else, thanks for listening. And we'll see you on the next Fan Experience podcast. Bye all.
And don't forget to check out our new website at fanexperienceco.com. The Fan Experience was recorded live. See you next time.